The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Hi, everyone. I think we're going to get started. How are you all? We're so glad to have you here for the Profiles of Legal Careers in Federal Government. We're thrilled because we have a really terrific panel tonight. So listen carefully as all these wonderful alumni describe their careers in federal government, how they got there, their current positions, and tips on the job search and their strategies. There's going to be a question and answer session immediately after the panelists' presentations. I think also if you have questions maybe during, we'll see how it goes, that we can also raise them then. So I was going to go ahead and read everyone's bios, but I changed my mind, and I think the best thing to have happen is for all of these wonderful people to explain to you what exactly they do and how they got there. So I'm just going to introduce you to all of our panelists, and we will go from there. So this is Michael Belgrade. He's the Associate Counsel in the Litigation Coordination Division in the Office of Chief Counsel at the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, which is part of DHS. So we are also, next is Rachel Schumi, and she's a legislative analyst in the Office of Management and Budget in the Executive Office of the President. She's also a PMF Fellow, Presidential Management Fellow. She's part of that program as well. And then we have Gail Kirsch, who's the Deputy Chief in the Legal Policy Section and Special Counsel for Federal State Cooperation at the Department of Justice, and she's in the Antitrust Division. So I hope I got that all right. If I didn't get it all right, please, everybody can correct me. But like I said, we will go ahead and start with Mr. Belgrade, and he will tell you whatever he would like to tell you, all about what it is that he does and some other things you guys might want to know. So thank you again. We are thrilled, and we're so thrilled to have our panelists.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. My name is Michael Belgrade. As you can see, I work at DHS in Citizenship and Immigration Services. I have not been there for so long. I've only been there for around 6-7 months. I work there as an attorney. I work specifically in the litigation division. One thing you may or may not know about government practice if you're working as a government attorney is that in litigation, there is only one government entity that is allowed to represent the government before judges in court, and that's Department of Justice attorneys. For the area that I work in, those folks end up being either assistant U.S. attorneys that are sprinkled throughout the United States or the Department of Justice's Office of Immigration Litigation. They're the only folks that are allowed to speak before a judge in court and represent the government. So one might ask, what is the purpose of having a litigation office when you can't actually litigate? One might say, I have a great job that way. I do. The reason why I have a great job is because my job is essentially to serve as agency counsel. I describe it very much as the equivalent of an in-house counsel position, where we are ensuring that views of our agency are being properly represented by our Department of Justice colleagues, and we work with our Department of Justice colleagues in any and all pleadings that they provide before the court, any and all arguments they're going to make before the court. At the same time, DOJ is going to need from us information from our client, my client, which is Citizenship and Immigration Services, to ensure that our arguments are best properly represented. Let me give you just a quick, brief background of the different legal offices that exist in Citizenship and Immigration Services, and then I'll tell you a little bit more about me and how I actually got this great job. There are, I believe, 5 different divisions, legal divisions in Citizenship and Immigration Services. There's the division I work in, which is litigation. There is, I'd say, the 2 substantive offices, meaning the ones that deal directly with immigration, the immigration experts. One is the Adjudication Law Division. And the other one is the asylum division. That's asylum, refugees, etc. Then there are 3 other areas. There's mine, litigation support, and then there's 2 others. One is commercial and administrative law. Anyone here on the ALR, Administrative Law Review? No one? Okay. Someone in the back. I was actually an ALR editor back in the day when I went to this fine institution. So we have, believe it or not, they read the ALR when it comes out. shocking but true. So we have essentially commercial administrative law attorneys that are making sure we're following everything we're supposed to, whether it is HR issues, whether it's legislative issues on the Hill, etc., whether it's rules and regulations. And then we also have, outside of that division, I forgot the last one, but essentially, my point is that even though you're working in as a lawyer for the government, it's not necessarily true that you'll be the person doing the substantive work that the agency does, namely in mine, immigration benefits. You could be doing a slew of other stuff that the agency needs done, whether it's procurement, whether it's HR, whether it's all kinds of other stuff that, as an agency, it needs lawyers to advise them appropriately. So just because a government agency works in a specific area doesn't mean necessarily that you have to be an expert in that area. You can provide a service for them, for the agency, and something that it needs that isn't necessarily substantive to the mission of the agency itself. Now, how did I get this great job? Well, prior to joining DHS, I was a foreign service officer with the State Department for 6 years. In fact, that's where I went for work when I got out of law school, which is not a law job at all. It's a policy job. I was hired as a political officer. And the experience I got at State is what actually pushed me into my job at DHS. Because for my first 2 years in the State Department, I was a vice consul. I was a consular officer. And I did nothing but adjudicate visas and passports and deal with all kinds of stuff like that, which made me an expert in the area that the current agency I work for, pretty much what they do. I became an expert, at least a substantive part of it, which was non-immigrant visas. The second part of that expertise that got me there was the ability to manage and work problems out. A lot of times, government attorneys aren't doing pure legal work, but they're doing a lot of problem solving as well. And a lot of my work at State required that. Just by brief background, I was a vice consul in Tel Aviv for 2 years. I was the political officer at our consulate general in Sydney, Australia for 2 years. Nice post. And then I was the economic officer in the Office of Israel and Palestinian Affairs at the State Department for 2 years. I didn't sleep for 2 years. That job is pretty crazy. And then I moved to DHS. I'll tell you two other brief things about me, and then I'll pass it on to our other panelists here. One is that I was a PMI my third year of law school, which is now called the PMF. I also took the Foreign Service exam at the same time, and I got into both programs, the PMF and the Foreign Service, so I chose Foreign Service. The reason why I mention this is because I believe the PMF program is really a wonderful way to figure out beforehand whether or not you want to spend a career in government without causing too much damage to your life. It gives you a good entry. It enables you to see other parts of the government other than the specific agency you might be interested in. You know, you might be interested, let's say, in the Department of Commerce, but then you spend 3 weeks at Treasury and like, oh, actually, I think Treasury is really more what I like. Or you spend 2 weeks at the Department of Defense and go, oh, I really like procuring lots of weapons. I think I want to do this instead. So, I mean, it just depends who you are and what you're interested in. The other thing that I would highly recommend while you're in law school, if you have the time, is that when you look at most government positions, they require experience beforehand in the area that you're looking for. Not all of them, but I'd say a lot of them require experience beforehand. And if you're going through law school and you're doing your courses are not going to be enough experience for the most part to get you that job there. It's going to require you doing something more. So whether that means interning in something that would be in a program or externing in a program that would be relevant to that area, doing something over the summer, working for that office as an intern before, and kind of targeting where you would want to work and then offering your service there beforehand. I think that's very valuable because you find after law school, once you start working, if you don't have the experience that government agency is looking for, it's highly unlikely they're going to hire you. I mean, I think that's just a reality. So that would be the unsolicited advice I would give there. I'll be glad to answer more questions during the Q&A section, but I'll pass it on now to my other colleagues. Thank you.
I'm Rachel. I graduated from WCL just last year, not in 08, but in 07. So I still very freshly feel your law school pain. walking through the halls here was a little terrifying. I think I should start telling you a little bit about what I do by telling you about something that will be relevant. You may have seen yesterday while you were surfing the internet during one of your classes that there was this really horrendous story in the Washington Post about this woman who had adopted several children, killed them, stuffed them in a freezer, and continued to collect her state adoption incentive payments for 2 years. Yesterday as well, I received a bill from Congress which would fix this problem. It would basically create all of these stop gaps in the adoption assistance payment system so that people who were abusing their children or had killed their children or didn't even really have adopted children could not get state payments. So this bill had gone through the whole legislative process. It arrived on my desk because it had been passed by both the House and the Senate and was ready to be signed for the president. When a bill is ready to be signed or vetoed by the president, it comes to me. And I, if it's in my area of interest, I mean, if it comes to my office, and then it comes to me if it's in one of my issue areas, and I write a memo to the president saying, this is what this bill does, and you should sign it, or you should veto it. So that sounds pretty cool for someone who's in their first year out of law school. So let me tell you a little bit how I got to this position where I, as a non-political appointee, make very important decisions for people like the president. I am a PMF, which Michael told you a little bit about. I think that the PMF program is significantly different now than it is than when it was the PMI program. Now you apply for the PMF program in your final year of graduate study, regardless of what your program of study is, and you enter a 2-year full-time fellowship after you graduate. Each agency runs their fellowship a little bit differently. My agency, which is the Office of Management and Budget, you are hired into a full-time position on sort of a 2-year trial period, and you are treated like a regular employee. You draw a regular salary. You spend your 2 years at OMB, and then when you're done, you get a big raise and a big promotion, and you stay there. At other agencies, sometimes they shift you around a lot within the agency. Sometimes you are treated more like an intern. It's really different at each agency, and each program has its pros and cons, but I know that Heather is planning on having more sessions about the PMF program, and you're welcome to ask me more questions about that. But basically, when I graduated from law school, I knew that I did not want to be a lawyer. I was not interested in being a lawyer. I never really had been, but I knew that I wanted a Washington job where I could affect policy that I cared about, and I knew that in this town, having a law degree would get me a lot farther in the application process than not having a law degree. So I went to law school, spent 3 very painful years in this building, graduated as a PMF, and started applying for jobs all across the federal government, mostly in congressional liaison offices at different agencies. When I started my job search through the PMF process, I had no idea that the job I currently hold existed. I had never even heard of the Office of Management and Budget, which...
She hasn't heard of the Department of Justice.
That one I have heard of. And so I found my job just through a random posting at a career fair and realized that it was exactly what I wanted to be doing, applied, was lucky enough to get the job. And in my office, there are 16 people who do what I do. Most of them have law degrees. We are respected for our law degrees and asked a lot of legal questions and especially legislative interpretation questions. So having a law degree has proved very helpful. But there are 16 people in my office, and basically the entire executive branch of the government is broken up between those 16 people. So I cover all of housing, the housing programs at HUD, the disaster housing programs run by DHS, rural housing, and veterans housing, as well as anything where the government gives you money for something that you can't afford yourself, like welfare, food stamps, adoption assistance, foster care assistance. So within those areas of the government, I basically do 3 things. I make sure that all the political people in the White House are aware every single day of what's happening on the Hill and what they've done on the Hill to affect my pieces of legislation that fall into those areas. I coordinate the administration position on all of those bills. So if if, for example, HUD wants to write a letter to Congress saying, we really, really, really hate this bailout package that you're trying to push through right now, that letter would have to come to me before they could send it to the Hill, and my office would send it out to a bunch of other agencies, get the comments, start a big negotiation process, produce a final product, and then give HUD the clearance to send that letter. And then the third thing is what I was explaining earlier, that when a bill is ready to be signed by the president, I write a memo to the president explaining what the bill does and how much it would cost and whether he should sign it or whether he should veto it. So that is pretty much how I got to where I am. One final thing, just to sort of echo what some other people have said. When I started law school, I knew that I could either work really, really, really hard and graduate with a pretty decent GPA, or I could work just hard enough to graduate and spend all of my time working outside of school to build up a really good resume so that I could get the kind of job I wanted when I graduated. I don't think it has to be so black and white, but I spent every single semester I was in law school working or interning. I worked mostly on the Hill, and then I also spent a little bit of time working on campaigns and a little bit of time working in the nonprofit sector. And I know that having that kind of experience on my resume is what got me this job. So I just want to echo what Michael said, that if you have a resume that shows that you have experience in what you want to do, you're much more likely to get a job in the government. For the last position that was open in my office, we received 2,000 applications, and we hired a PMF because when you hire a PMF, all you have to do is just hire them. You don't have to go through all 2,000 applications. But know that federal jobs are really competitive, so if you can show a resume that shows a long-term interest in what this job is and some experience, you're in a really good place.
I want to take one moment and just introduce Alton Turner, who is Senior Counsel at the Securities and Exchange Commission in the Enforcement Division. And actually, we'll have Gail speak, and then we'll come back to you. Is that all right?
That's fine.
Okay.
Thanks.
Sounds good.
Sorry for being late, everybody. I was on a call speaking about random stuff that you really want to hear about.
That has to do with securities. We don't.
Yeah. Enforcement.
I'm Gail Kirsch, and I also graduated from the Washington College of Law, except not last year, 29 years ago. But I still remember also, and I actually live in the neighborhood, and I walk at night, and it's me sometimes, because I've been walking for the last 20-something years. And every time I go by the library, I still smile that I don't have to walk in. So it lasts a really long time, Rachel. But I am delighted to be here and part of this panel. If I seem a little incoherent, because I just flew in from South Africa the other day and sort of still a little jet lagged, but I had a great trip and I actually worked there, so I had fun too. But I went there on the government. Thank you, Rachel, also for helping out in that. And did a fabulous panel over there for their competition bureau. And then got to go do a safari and other kind of fun things all on the tab of the government. So there are perks for working for the government after all.
Don't keep repeating that.
But I did really good work there, Jill. So my entire career has been at the Department of Justice in the Antitrust Division. And I thought what I would do is try to briefly summarize for you why I've had such a great career at DOJ. And I went on to the department right from law school on the honors program, which some of you may have heard about. But if not, I'll briefly tell you about that. And there's a flyer in the back for next year. Obviously, the application process is already over. But for those of you who still have an opportunity in the future, I'd really urge you to take a close look at the flyer and pay attention to the deadlines and go online and get more info. But I went on the honors program to the Antitrust Division in 1979. Actually, October 2nd, 1979 is when I started. So next year is an important anniversary. That means 30 years. And I invested, and I can go do whatever I want because I have my pension. But it's been a great career, and if I were given the opportunity again today, looking back, to make that decision, I wouldn't hesitate for an instant. I'd do the exact same thing. So it's really great to look back at 29 years of practicing law and pretty much say it's been wonderful. And so let me tell you why it's been so wonderful. And why I think the Department of Justice is a place you ought to think about. I was going to specifically talk about the Antitrust Division because that's been my experience, but I know from lots of friends and colleagues that justice generally is a wonderful place. So I've basically come up with five reasons why I think justice and the Antitrust Division in particular is so great. And the first is the work itself. At the Antitrust Division, the work has been incredibly challenging. It's been rewarding, and I know some of you who know what antitrust is all about, you think this is odd, but it's actually been a lot of fun. The basic role of the Antitrust Division is to ensure that the economy remains competitive and that we have a productive, efficient economy, and we do that by enforcing the antitrust laws to prevent things like cartels and collusion and abuse of monopoly power or the unlawful acquisition, maintenance, or attempt to get a monopoly, not monopoly itself, but the unlawful acquisition of a monopoly or maintenance. And you might have heard about a little case we had recently involving Microsoft. We also had little cases involving AT&T and many other companies. So it's actually very challenging work, but it's fun work. We also, I don't know if some of you know, but our work is not only civil antitrust enforcement, but we also have criminal enforcement. And you basically do grand juries and bring criminal trials in front of juries, and that's a tremendous amount of fun. You work with FBI agents. You get to do searches on premises at all hours of the night and morning. You get to, and now because so many of the cartels are global in nature, we coordinate with a lot of our foreign enforcers and work on a lot of global cartel enforcement, which is very exciting. People get to travel and do depositions and interviews and coordinate document searches in all parts of the world. So that's a lot of fun, and in my career, I've had an opportunity to do every aspect of antitrust enforcement except for appellate work. So I've done civil trials, merger trials, I've done criminal trials, I've done tons of grand juries, and now for the last 5 years, I've been doing just policy at a broader level. And I also do coordination with all the state attorney generals, and I coordinate between the Department of Justice antitrust and all the state attorneys general because they too have antitrust laws and they often work with us. And my job is to make sure we work as cooperatively as possible and to prevent problems and encourage good working relations with our state agencies. The work at the division is really terrific because at a very early stage when you come in, you're given as much responsibility as you're able to assume. And I, in fact, at my first, after a couple of years, I got to be on my first criminal trial. It was a 3-week trial, and I got to take witness, and that was after a year of grand jury. I got to take witnesses at the trial, cross-examinations, and I got to do closing argument. And there were 4 co-defendants, and each of those defendants had the highest priced lawyers you could imagine from New York. And they had associates there working on those trials who didn't get to say one word in the courtroom, not one word. And they had been practicing a far longer and making a lot more money than I was. But I got to sit at the bench with 2 other attorneys, the lead attorney, myself, and a junior attorney, and got to be an active member and do a, you know, hour and a half, 2-hour closing argument. And that was after maybe 4 years of being at the Antitrust Division. So, you know, there's lots of opportunities in the Department of Justice if you're willing and able to do it. And I think that is a reason why a lot of young lawyers really seek out the department as a place to start their career. Sometimes you'll work very long hours, so don't think if you come to the government it's a 9-to-5 or 8:30, 4:30, because actually it's not. But I think there's, and probably Rachel, you could vouch for this too, and everyone else here who is working for the government, is that there's, I think, a real difference when you work long hours because you're committed and you care and it's your case or your matter or your issue, than because everyone around you is counting the hours and the billable hours and you just have to do it or else you're gone. There's a much greater collegial feel. It's because, you know, it's yours. It's just something you own and you feel very committed to the goal, to the mission, and it really makes a big difference because while you're tired, and sometimes we all get cranky when we work really long hours, there's a great spirit. And having been through 3 major antitrust trials, which are very difficult, and you're working 24/7 for a very long time, and you have very big trial teams, and then you see these law firms, which, you know, maybe they take over the penthouse in the hotel, and we take over the basement, yeah. But we were happy, and we were having a great time, and they were miserable. So I don't know if that's always the case, and I don't want to stereotype, but it is true that most of the people I've worked with who have worked really hard on matters have really enjoyed it, and did it because they wanted to, not because someone required them to. The second reason why I think it's great to work at the Department of Justice and the Antitrust Division is because, at least in antitrust, you get to work in teams. It's very rare that you'll work on an antitrust investigation or trial just by yourself. I mean, it's impossible that you'll work by yourself. And it not only gives you an opportunity to learn, but it creates a great collegial atmosphere. And I found in my 29 years that almost all of the attorneys and economists I have worked with have been terrific. Terrific people and just great colleagues and really, really bright people from whom I have learned a tremendous amount and I'm still learning. And I just think that's a wonderful way to work. And the hierarchy within staffs is minimal. There's always a lead attorney. Yes, and there's going to always be someone at the bottom. It's probably going to be you if you're just the first one in. But there's a great ability to work together. And the hierarchy is quite limited. You're really a member of the team. And, in fact, I talked recently to an attorney who had come on laterally from a law firm, been a law firm, I think it was about 8 years. And he told me one of the things he loved about the division was, as he called it in antitrust jargon, the horizontality, that it's really a great horizontal playing field, and that is really true. The third reason why the division is so great is because we have an absolutely first-rate mentoring and training program. That we now have people who are just in charge of training lawyers, and paralegals who just work on training. So not only do you get to work in your team, but when you come in for the first few years, you will have a very formal training program that teaches you how to do depositions, how to do grand jury witnesses, mock arguments, subpoenas, and you'll go through these little stages. So while you're doing your work, you'll also be part of a training, an official training program, so I think that's terrific. You'll partake in tons of brown bags on substantive issues, on trial techniques, and you'll even go away for a couple of days where you'll be given all these overview of everything having to do with antitrust. So there's a lot of effort put into training our new attorneys and economists, and I think that's just a wonderful thing, and that wasn't true when I came. I mean, I don't recall getting any training except outside. We did have then the NITA program, which was wonderful, National Institute of Trial Advocacy. We had some training programs, but now it's very developed, and it's a wonderful thing for the new attorneys coming on board and the economists. And if I didn't mention it, the antitrust division has both economists and lawyers. We have a very large group of terrific, top-notch economists, and they are part of every team. So when you go to work on a case or investigation, you'll have at least one economist, if not more, assigned, and they'll be part of your team. So I know the word antitrust sometimes scares people, and I never thought I was going to be an antitrust lawyer. It was not my strongest class when I took it here, and I got interested in it when I did an independent paper, I was really interested in international law and trade, and I thought that's what I was going to do, and got interested in international aspects of antitrust and went to interview on the honors program and was supposed to start in the foreign commerce section, which was called at the time, but by the time I was ready to come on board a year later, they were no longer putting attorneys in that section, so my second choice was some litigation section, and ended up doing things that I never thought I'd do and loved it. So sometimes you don't quite know where you're going to end up or what you're going to really enjoy. And the fourth reason is it's a great lifestyle. Despite that there'll be times you work really hard, there's also downtime, and there are times when you could be home on the weekends or not be working on the weekends or not having to work at night. So, you know, you have to work really hard when you have to work really hard, but when you don't have to work the extra hours because the work doesn't require it, there's no one there saying, you know, are you here the extra hours? And I've been able to litigate, be a manager, and raise a family, and I feel I've been able to do that in a fairly normal way. So if that's important to you, I think the federal government is something to seriously think about. And they also have, of course, various flex programs and, you know, day off if you work an extra hours. And I think people are generally accommodating and recognize that there is something outside of work. It's not all about work. And finally, but very, very important to me, and I'm sure all of us share this, is I think the opportunity to represent the United States is wonderful. And my most rewarding time in my career at the Antitrust Division was the first time I got to do a trial and stand up in court and introduce myself and say, "Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Gail Kirsch, and I represent the United States of America." I'm telling you, there's nothing like it. It's a wonderful feeling. You sleep well at night, and most of the time you feel really good about what you're doing. All the time, but most of the time. And just quickly then, so, you know, that's my promotion pitch for the Antitrust Division, and I'm sure it would apply to the rest of Justice as well. And, you know, you can see, again, from the handout, the different programs we have, but I'll quickly tell you about them. There are the ones that would be of interest to the lawyers in the group. There's the Attorney General's Honors Program, which I got hired through, and that's the main way that the Antitrust Division and the department brings on new lawyers. Most new lawyers have to go through the Honors Program, so you have to have just graduated law school or just finished a clerkship. If you've gone out and worked, let's say, in a private firm, then you no longer qualify for the honors program. And then you have to be a lateral hire. Now when we have a budget problem, thank you, Rachel.
I don't work on the budget.
I know. Now we have budget freeze. There's no lateral hiring, but the honors program is still going forward. So the honors program is really the way we would want to focus. And actually, you know, people have asked me, should I go to a private firm and then later go to Justice, or should I go to Justice and go to the private firm? I'm not sure what the right answer is, but I can tell you one thing that I have noticed over my career is that the new lawyers who come to Justice and stay for a couple of years at the Antitrust Division certainly are in very, very high demand. And they constantly get calls from recruiters and, you know, headhunters. So people are looking for junior lawyers who have experience at Justice. It's a very, very valuable marketing tool. And the problem with going the other way is your opportunities are maybe even more limited in getting into Justice, because when someone is looking for a lateral hire, they're looking for a very specific expertise or experience that's fitting the niche they need. You know, maybe they need someone who's done about 5 years, but not more than 5 years, not too little, not too much, who's had some trial experience, but, you know, so they're looking for something very specific. When we hire in honors, it's more general. You know, we're looking for very committed, dedicated, bright, caring people who have an interest in our work. So it's a general class. So I probably would try to go the honors program, and then if I wanted to try private, I'd, you know, after 4 years, think of going out. But you should also think that if you are going to a private law firm or some non-government, non-department office, you should just think about the department in the future. We also have a civil law intern program, and that's after your second year of law school that summer, and it's a paid program. Both the honors program and the summer law intern program called SLIP, they're both, you know, obviously paid positions, but they both have very, very strict deadlines. The applications usually become available in August. The deadlines are in September, and there's no slippage. There's no exceptions. So if you're thinking about it at all, really pay attention to those deadlines. And then finally, we have a volunteer legal intern program, and it's a rolling application. And some sections take volunteers for the summer. Sometimes the volunteers split their time with another position they may have. Like they'll come for 6 weeks to the antitrust division and go for a few weeks somewhere else. My recommendation, if you're considering a volunteer, I have two pieces of advice. One, I probably would just do it for the whole summer wherever you go, because I don't think you'll have enough time if you split it to get involved enough in the work to be, one, of value to you, and two, for you to show what you can bring. And two, and something I mentioned to Heather, so I'm just going to say it, extremely important, wherever you do a volunteer position, don't approach it as, oh, I'm just volunteering and, you know, I don't have to take it as seriously. I can do other things. I don't have to work as hard because they're not paying me. If you're going to take that approach, don't do it. At least don't do it in the Justice Department, because you're going to both hurt yourself and you're going to hurt the school's image. You've got to take that volunteer position like you are getting paid, like a big law firm on K Street or something, and you're there to do the very best you can to show what you can bring, because that's only going to help you, because that's your opportunity if you want to then come back on the honors program to make the kinds of contacts, because that can make all the difference in the world. So, and also, for even if you don't want to come back, so that the school thinks, you know, we want to have students from AU. So that's really a piece of advice I give you all. You know, never take a volunteer position and treat it any less seriously than you would something you're getting paid for. So I think that's pretty much it. I just wanted to emphasize one other thing that's very important to me and very important, I know, to the Antitrust Division. And that is that the Antitrust Division has made a real effort, particularly in the last 4 or 5 years, to try to reach a very diverse group of law students. I know my Assistant Attorney General is extremely interested in making sure that the Antitrust Division has a very mixed group of lawyers. We want lawyers from different ethnic backgrounds, from different racial backgrounds, from different geographic, cultural backgrounds, because Antitrust Division really believes that the broader our base of attorneys, the better we'll be as an institution. The work we do will be better. We'll add to each other, and the result is going to be a better result for the division, for the department, and for the public. So we're very committed to it. I personally have gone around here to Howard, to GW, part of the ABA, to talk on programs about antitrust and also to reach a broad base of students. So I just want to make that plug for the division. And finally, so I don't forget, one thought when I was, you know, talking about the kinds of things you might want to do, in addition to internships, another real good thing to do, I didn't do it, but it's something I think probably a really good thing to do, is to participate in the ABA's student programs or committees. The ABA, I understand it, is free to law students. You don't have to pay anything. And they have all these committees. And you should join and volunteer and do work for committees in areas that you think you're interested in. One, it could give you exposure to the lawyers in Washington, D.C. who are doing the work you're doing. And it'll, you know, you'll learn something, and it'll also make tremendous contacts. So I'd really urge you to think about doing that. That came up at a couple of panels that were actually sponsored by the ABA, but I really think it's a great thing for a student to do, and it's a way for you to meet your legal community and also for them to get to know you.
I just want to say, Michael actually has to leave a little bit early, so before we get to Alton, if anybody,
sorry,
keep skipping over you, that's what happens. If anybody has any specific questions for Michael, and I'm sure that, you know, if you want to email me, I can pass them along to him also, that's, you know, that's totally fine as well, but here's a few moments. He's, as you know, has done a lot of exciting things. I don't know if anyone has some questions about his time in the Foreign Service or anything else or all the wonderful things that he's done. But like I said, you can email me, and I can pass the questions along if your brain just isn't there yet. In a good way, just because there's a lot of different information. So I just wanted to make sure. Yeah?
It's always been my understanding that Foreign Service officers have to take, like, an exam.
That's correct. The Foreign Service... the great thing about the Foreign Service, and I can tell you both great things and awful things about it, like in any place, I'm not interested in necessarily plugging one place or the other, but trying to give you an honest assessment of positives and negatives of any job. The great thing about the Foreign Service is that it's a test-based entry. So you don't have to have contacts. You don't have to have spent hours working people to get in. You just have to pass two tests. You have to pass a written exam that's offered at least once a year. It's supposed to be offered at least once a year. I believe last year was all offered in April. It's the jack-of-all-trades, master-of-none test. You have to know a little bit about everything, because that's what they're looking for. They're looking for that supposedly worldly individual that can, on the one hand, talk about a Monet painting, and on the other hand, talk about compound interest, which is always a question on the exam. Why, I don't know. But I memorized the equation and got the answer right. No, I don't know the equation now. So it's a written exam. It's an all-day exam. It's multiple-choice questions, covering everything from reading comp to history to art to culture to economics to... It's not really something you can study for beforehand, although I memorized three things walking to the exam: GDP, GNP, and compound interest. Compound interest was one of the questions, but that I would recommend. But short of that, unless you're an economic whiz, and then please, I don't want to waste your time, but that's the one half of the test. If you pass that, and I don't know what the percentage passing rate is, it's under 50%. I think it's 25%, but I don't know for certain. Don't quote me. Then there is an oral exercise you go through if you pass the first prong. And they constantly change it purposely because they don't want people like me to tell you what it is, and then you, so to speak, game the system. But when I took it back in 2001... the test consisted of three parts. We had a mock budget that we had to figure. We had a certain amount of projects, a certain amount of money, and of course there were going to be winners and losers, and each one had to represent a different part of the budget and give a presentation to the ambassador, the quote-unquote ambassador of what it would be. That was one part. The second part was a one-on-one interview where they asked you, I would say, three types of questions. One would be, basically your background. The second one would be, why do you want to do this kind of work, that kind of thing. And then the third was the how you overcame difficult situations in your life, the Oprah section, as I call it. And I did fairly well. I think I got them crying towards the end, which I think is the objective, kind of the Dr. Phil standard. But no, I'm kidding on that, of course. But a little bit. But, and then the third part is, and let me just say as well that the we had to be there at some ungodly hour, like 7 a.m., and they start you at 8 and then at 10, and then they stretch it out throughout the day, because part of what they're doing is they're trying to see your stamina, your tenacity, how much you can withstand as far as, you know, time in between different things. And then 2 in the afternoon, they ask you to do a memo on the thing you did at 8 in the morning regarding the memo. So suddenly you have to hopefully remember a bunch of stuff or write them down, because any of the materials they give you, you won't have in front of you to sit down and write this memo. They'll give you a computer, and that's about it. And then at the end of the day, around 3 or 4 o'clock, they tell you who passes. You find out then and there who passes and who fails. I always found it funny, because I thought, you know, I failed, and the people I was in that team with failed, because we never actually wrote the memo to the ambassador. We figured it all out. But we never wrote the memo. I'm like, well, that's it. Waste of a day. We all failed. We're a bunch of losers. And 4 or 5 of us passed. And we were the only ones that passed from the group of 20 that came that day. It's not winning or losing, but it really was, they were testing how you play the game, how you negotiate with people, active voice, listening, looking at someone, not cutting them off, being constructive, building on other people's ideas. That's what they were looking for, I think. So if you pass the orals as well, and one other thing to mention about the orals, as you may or may not know, there's five different cones in the Foreign Service, different sections or groups. So I entered as a political officer, as a political coned officer, but there's economic, consular, public diplomacy, and management. It used to be called administrative, but now they're called management. And depending on which cone you choose, you have to score either higher or lower based on the demand. And political was the most sought after, had the highest demand, so you had to score the highest from the others versus management may have been, at that point it was called administrative, it may have been one of the lower prongs, so it required less. It changes every year, so it's not the same every year. And then after passing the orals, you have to pass a security clearance and a physical. Physical I passed by some miracle, and then although I was much skinnier then. And the security clearance is a top secret security clearance. Every Foreign Service officer is required to carry at least a top secret clearance, which requires essentially a three-prong review of you, your family, and your associates to ensure that there are no issues. I got my clearance September 7th, 2001. That was a good day to get it, because if it was anything after 4 days after that, you can imagine it would take longer. Security clearances take much longer now. One thing that wasn't mentioned in any of this is a security clearance is highly sought after in the government. If someone could hire you with a security clearance and not have to wait a year to get someone new, they'll choose that. So if you're going to intern, let's say, in the government, that requires them getting a clearance beforehand for you, that's really valuable. Even if it's an interim secret clearance or even just confidential or whatever, I think it's a valuable thing to have and wasn't mentioned until now.
If you want to go into the private sector as well, it's very valuable.
A lot of contractors like that, yeah.
Any other questions for me? Yeah.
You mentioned you successfully moved from the State Department to DHS.
Yes.
Can you talk a little about your experience specifically moving between agencies and in general what you might know?
Nightmare. No, it wasn't too bad. I just got my leave days from state, moved to Homeland. It only took 6 months. That gives you an idea of how easy. I was offered the job at Homeland the day before Thanksgiving. I started in March. Government doesn't always move quickly, even transferring from one government agency to another. I left state with a top secret SCI clearance, which is probably one of the highest clearances you could have. There are a few that are higher, but it's a pretty high clearance. I moved into a job that only requires me to have a secret clearance. In other words, I downgraded in clearances, and yet it took them, you know, from November to March to get all that paperwork and everything moving. So it's not necessarily the easiest of processes, but I think when you're in the government, especially if you're on the GS, the government scale, which not everyone is on, it's easily translatable at the very least. They can determine what your, so to speak, rank is in the government based on where you stand on the GS, what your pay is, what your level is. Coming from the Foreign Service of the State Department, I didn't have a GS. So I had, the Foreign Service has its own Foreign Service scale, which descends as the rank gets higher. So the lower number you are, the higher rank you are, whereas with the GS, it's the opposite. It's the higher the number, the higher the rank, which actually makes sense. So that could also play a role as well as far as negotiating a better salary in your next job. But depending on the fact that I had a lot of experience in immigration and the kind of work that they were looking for at DHS, plus I had contacts from state, which was really a great thing for them as well. Instead of picking up the phone through an official channel and waiting 3 weeks to get a response, I can call three friends of mine and get the answer in 20 minutes. That's valuable. And so a lot of times government agencies might want to seek someone from another government agency because they can play a great role as a liaison. They can get information or get the right people to do things. If someone's officially supposed to do something, but when you know someone, it can sometimes happen a lot quicker. So, That's what I'd say about that. Anyway, my contact information is known to the career office here, and so if anyone would like to get in touch with me about any questions about the State Department or about Homeland Security, the government is a great place to work. We have flex schedule. I have a flex schedule. I work from home one day a week. I have three small children, so my wife works as well, so we try to make everything work. So in my agency, we're very blessed with some excellent benefits like the work schedule. We have student loan repayment. The government will be covering before taxes $10,000 of my student loan this year, probably around $6,000-$7,000 after taxes, but that's pretty attractive. It's a agency-by-agency basis. Not all government agencies do that, so it just depends. The other positive thing I'd say is that you hear a lot of negative things about DHS. And there are a lot of negative things going on at DHS. I'm not going to defend that. But one positive thing I'll say about the office I work for, first of all, DHS has 22 component agencies under it, one of which is the one I work for. So when you say DHS, it's a little bit, it's a bit too general. You have to really know which component you're working for. And the office culture where I work is, it's excellent. I think the leadership there saw the opportunity to create a new culture since, post 9/11, the creation of DHS. These folks saw basically what worked and what didn't work in the other government agencies they came from, and they tried to create a model that I think works really well. And I'd be glad to talk with people, offline about that at some point in the future. But I just want to thank you for giving me the opportunity to be here today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. I have to go.
And last but absolutely not least, Alton Turner from the SEC.
So you say. Well, thank you for having me. I'm sorry I was running late. Where should I start? I'm a 98 graduate of AU. Did the JD MBA program here. I finished my MBA in 2000. Took a little extra time because I wanted to start working actually after I got graduated in 98. But generally, I think they try to get you to do it now within 4 years. But it took a little time. Maybe I'm a little slow. I don't know. My first job at the school actually, I worked really closely when I was here with the Career Services offices because I thought it was really important to, make sure I had a good connection with them and, maintain a good relationship there because although they can help you find a job, you have to actually push the effort to find a job. So, whenever something came up in their office, I was the first person they called because, they saw I was in there all the time talking with them, getting their advice on things. Just stopping by, say hello, running things past them, random things, be it job related or just personal. And actually, funny thing is, I'm still friends with a lot of people who are no longer here, but they worked in the career services offices. And even now, they'll call me with random jobs. But my first job out of law school was working for a public company out in Maryland in their in-house counsel's office, which is pretty unheard of once you get out of law school. So I was doing my MBA as well as working there 30, 40 hours a week. Probably more than that because we did a lot of M&A work. So I was there for sometimes 60, 70 hours a week plus doing my MBA, which is pretty difficult. But it was a great experience. And generally, you don't get those positions or those types of opportunities right out of law school as a first-year student. And I was very fortunate. And again, that was because of my relationship with the Career Services Office. When the job came through, I was the first person they called. And they said, look, Alton's a hard worker. We want him to be here. This is a good opportunity for him. Can you please get them in for interview? And, things worked out. But, again, it's all about the relationships you make, I think. Not just outside of the relationships you make here at AU. I was talking to my intern yesterday about this, too, and she's just starting here at the SEC for the summer or for the semester, rather. And, I think something that's not emphasized enough with students is, in terms of finding jobs and figuring out what you want to do with your career, you actually have to take active control of that. Law school is a very arduous process. And it taxes you mentally, emotionally, physically sometimes. See, physically. You're tired, aren't you? And people don't really realize that, but they leave their job search, they leave their career in the hands of other people instead of actually taking an active role in, going out there and figuring out what they want to do. And that means talking with people anytime you can, coming to panels like this and talking to people who've been in the government for 30 years.
29.
29. just And actually reaching out to alumni. I mean, I don't know. A lot of people are actually pretty afraid to call alumni, and I don't think any alumni that I know, friends of mine, would ever turn away an AU student if they call and say, hey, I need your advice. I mean, a lot of times people call you and they're looking to get a gig. You know, that's, you know, a lot of times you don't have that capability. And, you know, sometimes people call you out of blue. You don't know them, that type of thing. But, you know, I don't think anyone who's graduated from AU would be unwilling to talk to you about their career and what their path from law school has been. And I think that's something that, you know, people really need to focus on as you get started in careers. I don't know if you're first, second, or third years here, but I think that's something I really want to emphasize to people. Really take control of your own career process and go out there and talk to people and figure out what you want to do. And, you know, it's trial and error. As I continue along now with my career, I'll finish my story. But anyway, I left that company out in Maryland because I got bought out by another company, and I went over to the NASD to do enforcement work for them. So primarily that involved doing investigations into financial frauds of broker-dealer members of the NASD. Now NASD is called FINRA, but pretty much we had oversight of the NASDAQ stock market, and the members would be, you know, broker-dealers who sold securities. So basically going into firms, you know, unannounced or announced, whatever the case is, doing inspections of the firm to make sure they complied with the NASD rules and regulations, talking to customers who felt aggrieved for whatever reason, their broker misled them or whatever the case was. But it was a pretty interesting job. It wasn't actually an attorney position, and that's something else I like to emphasize to people. You know, there are very non-traditional routes you can take to get where you want to go, and I think I heard that echoed here too. You don't have to come out of, you know, I think there's a certain arrogance attached to law. You know, I'm a lawyer. I got a JD. So, you know.
So does everyone else in this town?
You know, and that's something I think, you know, you should get over yourself pretty quickly. I don't say that to be facetious, but I mean, I find the attitude a lot of times when I meet, you know, young law students. You know, I'm the greatest thing since sliced bread. Well, you're not. You don't know anything really yet. Just relax. You know, you'll in time. You know, but. You know, I think that's one of the things that students should realize, you know, once you come out, really look for things that you have an interest in. And, you know, being on this side of my career 10 years out, gone through several different positions, and just living life a little bit, you know, you realize that, you know, you don't have to take a tried and true path to get where you want to go. I mean, you know you better than anyone else. And take what you know about yourself and what's interest you. And, you know, what do you think you want to do for the next 30 years? You know, you get to the end of your, closer to the end of your career, and you say, well, you know, I've had a great career. I've enjoyed my time at DOJ, or I enjoyed my time at Bob's Big Boy. Whatever the case is, you know, that's one of those things that I think, you know, people don't really tell you about. You know, you go through law school and, you know, you pay the price for it. But at the end of it, there is a price to pay, because being a lawyer is not an easy task sometimes. I feel fortunate because I've practiced with the government for the past, what, seven years now, and it's been a great experience for me. But I'm getting off track. Let me continue the story. So I left NASD, and you guys see how my thought process is. You know, I keep coming back, though. I left NASD, and I went over to the SEC because some people I worked with at NASD left to go over there into a new group called OCIE. And OCIE basically had oversight of the securities markets. So that involved going to all the stock exchanges across the country and doing on-site reviews of the exchanges, looking at their policies, procedures, the personnel, to see exactly what was going on in the exchanges. So we were basically called the eyes and ears of the SEC because we were actually out there in the field doing investigations and making recommendations to enforcement or other divisions about the way things should be done, you know. And if we thought something was stupid, we'd make that comment to them, or, you know, we'd go to the commission and ask them to change a rule or something like that, or work with other divisions to try to make that happen. I stayed there for about 2 years, and it was an interesting job, but I got onto a big case dealing with analyst conflicts matter. And that was a big deal a couple years ago, I guess 2003, 2004, that was a big deal where, you know, there are conflicts of interest between analysts and investment bankers. You know, they're basically selling research and doing a lot of the dirty things that, you know, you as investors should know about. I left there, and because of my work on that case, I went over to enforcement. And enforcement actually is the mechanism that actually enforces the SEC's rules and regulations or laws. And they actually entered in settlements with these firms we were investigating related to the analyst conflicts matter. And it was actually pretty exciting work. At the end of the day, we got a $1.5 billion settlement from about 12 different firms. for their conflicts of interest, and you know, made a lot of, I think, significant changes in the way things were done in terms of how research was issued or how investment bankers did their business. You know, just the inherent conflicts when you deal with an issuer who pays you. You know, if you're a banker and you know you're getting a $1 billion deal, you know, more likely than not, your firm's gonna, you know, give a good recommendation for the stock if your firm's selling it. So, interesting stuff like that. We got a chance to work on that type of case. And since then, I've transferred to enforcement, and I've been here for the past 5 years. Very interesting work, actually being called the tip of the spear at the edge of the empire. Actually being there in the forefront of things that are happening in the market, especially now when you see a lot of fraud that's happening. You know, you see all the $700 billion, you know, issue we have going on right now, and there's a lot of fraud underneath all that. So, I mean, we'll be busy for years dealing with the fallout from that. But overall, it's been a very good experience for me at the SEC. I've learned a lot. Some of the attributes we talked about at DOJ, you know, the schedule's great. The work is great. I haven't been bored at any point in time since I've worked there. You usually make pretty good friends, and that's the thing, too. You, when you get into the government, you can make a lot of friends, a lot of connections that can lead you to other areas as well. You deal with a lot of other agencies. I mean, I deal with DOJ a lot. We do a lot of parallel investigations. I mean, for example, I worked on one case over the past year or two where we did a parallel investigation with DOJ, and, you know, a lot of the stuff that we do is very similar, but the result of their case was the person got sent to prison for a year and got fined $1 million. I had a similar case, but I handled it on the civil side, so I'll probably get $1 million out of their pocket for something else. But it's a pretty interesting job, and it's pretty fascinating to see the type of power that you have, you know, going to work every day and seeing what you can actually do in terms of affecting change. And it may be little by little, but I think at the end of the day, it's important work. I know I'm rambling a bit here, but I just I guess I don't want to ask you guys if you have any questions at this point. Quiet.
Okay, as a JD MBA student, did you pursue internships in the financial sector, or did you look for legal internships? How did you do that during your law school?
That was a bit strange, actually, for me, because back then, people really didn't know how to classify you. JD, MBA, what are you? You're a hybrid, and we don't really know what to do with you. You know, firms are like, well, you know, at one point, I was actually doing my MBA classes for the most part, so I wasn't actually taking law classes. So they were like, well, why are you applying here? Are you a lawyer or are you a business person? You have to kind of figure out for yourself how you want to explain that experience. My spiel was that, you know, it makes me a better lawyer because I understand the business side of a transaction. You know, I'm not, you know, scared of a balance sheet or income statement. I can actually, you know, talk to an accountant. I mean, now in my job, I have to talk to accountants often. A lot of my cases deal with accounting fraud, so having to look at a balance sheet and explain to somebody else what, you know, asset write-down is and the impact it's going to have on the quarterly earnings and, you know, how the EPS is impacted by, you know, all these different things, it helps to have an MBA, and you have to actually try to put that all together and explain to people why you're a valuable resource because of that. To your question, though, in terms of jobs that I had, I wasn't quite sure what I wanted to do when I was in law school. I came here. I was a poli-sci major. Hadn't done business before. I took a couple business courses. I found it to be interesting, even though I didn't appreciate what I got in business associations. But I still found it to be a pretty interesting course of work. And, you know, I just took it from there. I worked at a broker-dealer one time. I'm out in Rockville. I worked for a tax attorney. I've worked so many jobs in law school, too, other than that. But, you know, I just did things I thought were interesting to me to make sure that that's the area I wanted to go into. And then just talked to a lot of people, and that, you know, helped me figure out what direction to go, who to talk to, or what associations to join, or, you know, what classes to take, for that matter, here. I don't know. I think that answers your question. I don't know. Does?
Yeah.
I'm sorry to
introduce that. No, no, that no, girl. You didn't. No, that's perfect. I'm glad you said that. So, before I certainly have questions, but I think it's better coming from you guys. So, this is a great opportunity. You've got three alums in three very different jobs, sort of, all in federal government.
I just had a question because you said there were some students maybe who are not in law school. Is there anyone here who's not in law school? Can I just quickly mention one possible? I didn't want to lose sight of you guys.
You guys are undergrad. I'm sorry. You guys are undergrad or freshmen?
Yeah. Freshmen? You had that relaxed look about you. That sort of faces that were too happy. Couldn't have been in law school. There's a program that the Department of Justice has, and again, I'm going to speak for the Antitrust Division, but something you ought to seriously consider if you're thinking you might be interested in law one day before going right to law school, which I'm not in favor of, but for many reasons. But one thing you ought to really seriously think about is the department, and again, the Antitrust Division has a paralegal program. It is a superlative program that was put into effect, I know during the Clinton administration, so whenever that was, that's when we put the official program into effect. And it is absolutely the best thing I could recommend you do if you have any interest in going to law school. And you come for 2 years, and you think you can extend it to a third year, and it is fabulous experience, top-notch experience, great group of paralegals to work with, all bright, eager, hardworking, and you will become a member of that team. And I have worked with many, many paralegals, and I can't tell you how great the experience is. It is top-notch, and I've never heard from anyone else, any other young people who have gone to other jobs or private law firms and done it, who can say anything that comes close to it. So I say that without qualification. If you're thinking of law school, check out that paralegal program. Again, it's called our Honors Paralegal Program. And even if you never thought you'd want to ever do anything called antitrust, the antitrust paralegal program is really top-notch. And you'll have a guaranteed, a great experience. And some of you may even find, because I had one wonderful paralegal who married a lawyer. I hired both of them, actually. And they got married, and they have kids now, and it's great. And but they went to, actually, they went to trial with us. I have to just tell you. They went to trial with us, and they thought no one knew. And then they, after the trial was all over and everything, they sort of announced they were seriously going out, and they thought they kept it a secret from all of, like, everyone knew. But the interesting thing is, Kelly, who was actually my assistant as paralegal and stuff, she decided, and particularly after that trial experience, she doesn't want to go to law school. So she went and got her MBA and went to work for NASDAQ, actually. But, you know, most of the people who have come as paralegals have gone on to law school, and they have, at least, and certainly the paralegals have worked in the policy section and appellate section in particular. They come into law school, I think, really with a great experience under their belt and puts them a little bit ahead of the curve. And all I can tell you is, do it. If you can do it, do it. It's the best thing you can do. Anyway. It's the honors. The honors program is for the lawyers after you've graduated. Graduating, you have to do it a year before to apply.
So you actually,
yeah, you would be entering your third year of law school. The application would come out in August, and then by September you would have to have it submitted. And then they have the interviews in October and decisions in November for the following. So then you'd be in your third year.
The reason I'm asking is because honors program is being offered through several different agencies.
Yeah, actually, the SEC actually offers the honors program as well.
In fact, are mentioning if you come in as at the end of your second year for summer program, more possible getting into the other one.
Okay. Well, I don't know. Let me tell you this: if you come in as as the SLIP, we call it summer law intern program, which is this after. The summer after your second year, right? If you get into that program, obviously, if you do a really good job and people like you, that's an advantage. Absolutely. No doubt about it. Is it required? No. Do most of the people do it that way? No. But you can get a, I forget what they call it now, because it's been a while since I've done it, but and I have done it. You can, there's a special term we call for getting sort of like an offer around, like, you know, be so happy with the person, you sort of jump over a lot of the process. You still have to go through it, but you're going to get a an offer in, of sorts. So, yeah, it's a great thing to do if you think you're interested in it, but it is not the way most people end up doing it.
And to add on to that.
Oh, no, you're sorry.
I was going to add on to that, too. In terms of working at the SEC, we also have a summer honors program, and I've actually worked on the committee for a number of years, too. I'm no longer on it now, but I've seen the process very up close. It does help you to work there. And like, you know, add on to what you said earlier, too. If you're at a job at an agency, you know, do the best you can, because that's the first thing that's going to happen. If you want to work there after, you know, do an internship there or something, the first thing I'm going to do, if I'm considering your application, I saw that you worked at the SEC, find out what group you worked in, call your supervisor and say, well, how were they? And they would say, well, they showed up. I'm like, okay, well, put your resume over here, the rest of that pile, and we'll get back to it when we can. I mean, you really want to go there and shine. And that's what people kind of underestimate about doing internships or other things at government agencies. They think, well, you know, this is all the ho-hum. I may not be getting paid and this and that. But, you know, it really pays to actually work your tail off. And even if you don't get a job offer there, or you don't have any aspirations of getting a job offer there, that reference, you know, if you want to go work for, you know, SCAD and ARPS and you worked at the SEC and there's an assistant director that will, you know, say you the best things in sliced bread, it's so competitive right now for positions, and people don't really, you know, pay attention to that. You know, it's the details that matter at the end of the day. I'll tell you now, just for the lateral hires, we probably have thousands of applications coming in now for positions that they post on USA Jobs. I mean, there are partners applying for staff attorney jobs now. Partners at major firms. I'm not talking about Billy's, you know, law firm over here. I mean, people who are making a lot of money who want to come work for the SEC. So, and I will apply to DOJ as well because of the experience you get there as well. And a lifestyle, too. People are looking for that as well. So, I mean, not to belabor the point here, but it does pay to work there. And actually, at the SEC, you actually get a process. If you work there 4 hours during the summer, you get to submit your application to the different divisions, and they like you. You get interviewed before everybody else does.
You know, just to add a real personal story, and I won't use his name. I had a paralegal for a number of years who was going to school here at night and worked. So he was a night student here and working for me, and he's great, absolutely terrific. And I worked with him for at least 3 years. Well, however law school takes for night school, because he was from the beginning, so 4 years, whatever it takes. Seemed like it was just a few minutes for me. And when he, after he left and he wanted to have a different experience, and he applied for a law firm here in town, a small law firm, and actually the partners in the law firm were all former DOJ people, and they called me, and actually it was a conference call, I remember, and I mean, I was crazy over this guy, and I couldn't tell him enough good things, and I mean, he was hired within 5 minutes. And then they asked him when he left if he could clone himself. And, you know, so there's nothing like making an impression on someone, and because they'll go to bat for you all the way, and this goes back to that paralegal program. He, because of the work he did for us while he was going to school, he is such a, he's a lawyer who can just jump into things and knows it from the bottom up. He's, you know, he's got that that paralegal experience is invaluable.
Anyway. And that's another thing, too. I mean, working in the government, you get that experience right away. I think somebody mentioned earlier about once you go to a firm, the experience you get isn't the same, you know, sitting on trial within your first couple of years. I mean, when I got to SEC, I was a little more experienced, but, you know, there's nothing like being able to go into a deposition and, you know, short deposition. You do the prep work for it. You get the exhibits. You know, everything's on your shoulders. So it's a lot of pressure, but at the same time, too, you never get that experience at a firm. I mean, I go into testimony now, and I see partners bring in their associates. And they take notes for 8 hours. They don't say a word. And they've been there for years. They just take notes. They don't say a word. people get into the partnership level and they've never done a deposition on their own before or never argued a case in court before. I mean, so it's not something, you know, you should take lightly. The government is a great place to start your career. And no matter what you want to do, if you want to go off and do something else or work at a firm later, I take a different point of view in terms of working at the government versus private sector. You can always go and work in the private sector, but it's tougher sometimes getting the government. If you can get one of those positions, people are going to, you know, be tripping over themselves to get to you. I mean, I've pretty much made my decision to stay in the government for now, but there are always recruiters calling, always firm jobs available. So you can always go back to that if you want to do that. But the experience you get to hit the ground running, you get to sink or swim kind of too. But, you know, you do get the experience right away.
I have a question for Rachel. When you write your memos to the president, telling him, you know, if he should sign a bill or not, what criteria are you using? Has he given you, this is what I like, Rachel, these are the kind of laws I want to pass? Who's telling you, you know, or how much input do you have yourself? Is it legal enough? Like,
well, what you should first understand about the memos is that the actual recommendation is one sentence.
Okay.
The meat of the memo is a very legal, very analytical description of what a bill does. I have no say in whether the president signs or vetoes a bill. And frankly, my recommendation would be completely the opposite of what he does 100% of the time. So that part is very small. The big part is making sure that you are able to take a huge, frankly, usually written in a foreign language piece of legislation and very quickly take it all apart and put it back together into something that makes sense to anyone reading it and that they can read it in 15 minutes and completely understand what they're doing.
Actually, my office gets your OMB, all those OMB referrals, so we review everything for competition issues or antitrust issues, and we'll submit comments if it's appropriate and necessary, mm-hmm. and it's one of the things we do.
I mean, that's where the recommendation comes from, is when we get a bill that's become enrolled, which means it's ready. We send it out to all the agencies that have a stake, and they all write back to us with their recommendation, and then we compile all of those recommendations, and that's what goes in sort of the one sentence. The sort of cool thing about my job, but also the difficult thing in terms of getting people to give you information, is that almost everything that I write is considered like a confidential communication within the executive office of the president. So oftentimes people don't want to give us information when they aren't going to be able to see the finished product and when they aren't going to be able to see where that information's going and how it might be used and how it might be twisted.
You've spoken about what you should do before you graduate from law school, but I'm at the other end of the spectrum. I've been out of law school for quite a while, and I'm here in an LLM program. In 79, I was working with New York City Transit. I went to law school when I was there, and I retired in 2004. Do you think the LLM will help as far as getting into a government position at this late stage? Because right now I'm basically doing a solo practice in immigration. That's why I'm getting a better foundation with the LLM. But this might have been better for Mr. Belgrade, and I'll email you about it. But do you think an LLM will help if you're a little past law school?
Because obviously we're not talking antitrust, because I don't think that fits. But I can tell you, I had a little immigration experience, not one I really wanted to do, but there was a period, you would know very well, because he said, like, justice does it. Well, there was a period recently when the civil division, the immigration office at Justice, was inundated with asylum briefs that were going to through the Federal Court of Appeals. And those are all handled at Justice. And they were so overwhelmed with the numbers that everyone in the Justice Department, from shore to shining shore, was given a brief or two to do, even if you knew nothing about immigration law. As I got to do an immigration brief, and I got a whole bunch of staff immigration briefs to review, and even got to argue at the Seventh Circuit, and people have to argue it. It's not something I would want to do, but we didn't have a choice. Everyone's doing immigration cases for a couple of years, maybe a year and a half, and then it ended. They were overwhelmed. One would think that if your focus is immigration, that there is a tremendous need, and that you ought to pursue that. very directly, because based on my limited experience, and I don't know what the numbers are now because it's stopped, when antitrust lawyers no longer have to do immigration cases, but it sounds like the need is still going to be for a long time very, very great. So you might have some opportunities there.
I don't know if I can speak into immigration, but I do know at the SEC, being part of the hiring process, I have seen people hired who were in other careers before, or who were actually lawyers in other practice areas who had some litigation experience or something similar, who were hired at the SEC. So I don't think it can hurt you getting your LLM, especially if you're going to specialize in that area as well.
I want to catch Rachel real quickly because I know it's getting close to 7, and I know people have things to do this evening, and I know your panelists were nice enough to give us a lot of time, and maybe we'll stick around a little longer, but I just wanted Rachel, if she wouldn't mind, because I know there's some people who are now applying for the PMF program, if you could just quickly give us sort of a summary, you know, nomination, assessment, finalist, you know, I know that we
okay.
have a lot of time, but just quickly for the
people. What it is for my benefit.
Okay.
Right. Yeah. No. Just
well, the Presidential Management Fellowship Program is a very easily explained as a fast track into a management career in the government. It's a 2-year program that you're supposed to graduate from, as a manager. In my agency, that doesn't work because I work for a very flat agency. It's basically analysts, branch chiefs, division directors, and that's it. So when you graduate from the PMF program, you're still an analyst until you become a branch chief. But in a lot of other agencies, after those 2 years, you're supposed to be promoted into a management position. To become a PMF, and also along the fast track, it's a very easy way for you to get a job in the government because you basically get appointed as a fellow or as a finalist. You go to a job fair, and you could have a job by the end of the first day of the job fair. It's very quick. All they have to do is interview and decide to hire you, and they can make you an offer. That is not the way the regular government job process works, which is why the PMF program is so attractive to you. The reason it's so attractive to agencies is because they can just look at your resume, decide they want to hire you, and make you an offer. They don't have to go through the 2,000 other resumes they got. They don't have to go through the whole approval process. They can just hire you. But the PMF process is not fair. That's probably the first thing you should know about it. It's entirely based on one assessment, which is about a 3-hour test. You fill out a very long application telling them all about yourself and your great accomplishments and attaching your resume. No one ever looks at that until you are already selected as a finalist, and then they give that information to agencies so that agencies can screen through and go through and pick out who they want to hire. But you're not selected as a PMF based on any of your experience. You're selected based on an assessment. It's a multiple choice test. It's 3 parts that are weighted equally. 1 part is reading comprehension. It's very, very easy. 1 part is basically a version of the LSAT that was written for kindergartners, which is why they have so many lawyers who are now scoring into the PMF process, which is great. I mean, there's no one in this room who should have a hard time becoming a PMF based on that part of the test. The 3rd part is a personality test. I mean, straight up. They are looking for social, outgoing, go-getter, leadership qualities. And that's it. If you say, you know, the color blue makes you feel sad and want to crawl into a little ball, you're not going to be a PMF. And that's really what the test is like. So it's really not fair because you get 1 chance to score well in those 3 areas. And if you do, you become a PMF and you get this very quick fast track, and if you don't, then you have to go through USA Jobs like the rest of
the world. Yeah.
Yeah.
I have never heard of that.
Yeah. That's because Justice doesn't do it.
Because, that's fine.
Oh, this is the really important thing about the PMF program. There are no lawyer jobs in the PMF program. Forgot about that. For me, that was never an issue because I didn't want to be a lawyer. All of the jobs are pretty much analyst jobs. All of the jobs are very similar to what I do. For all agencies.
Then you don't need a law degree.
No. It's open to any person in the United States in their last semester of any course of graduate study.
Okay.
But I will tell you, it's very easy to get in as a lawyer because that LSAT portion. And if you are a lawyer, it's very easy to get a job. A lot of agencies see that, and they have this whole thing that they think, oh, you're a lawyer. You must be really great. You must know a lot. Let's hire you. Even if you have no skills in budget analysis.
So it's after graduate school.
It's after graduate school. Hmm. And it's only open to people entering their last year of graduate school. So basically you get 1 chance. If you don't apply at that 1 window, you're done.
Or you can go back to school.
Yeah, that's true.
So do people move around from different, like after they've worked in something that they got through PMF, do they move around to like other agencies? And I mean, are you able to later, if you decide that you would like a lawyer job or something?
Yes, that's actually one of the main reasons why people do the PMF, because it's really, really easy to make lateral moves within an agency and between agencies. So, like both of my fellow panelists have said, sometimes it can be very difficult to move agencies. When you're a PMF, it's not. It's very easy to jump from office to office or from agency to agency. In fact, as a PMF, you're required to do a 4 to 6 month rotation within your 2 years. Some agencies require that you do it within your agency, but a lot of agencies let you move. So most people will just take a PMF job doing something that they're not really interested in because they know that they can find a detail that they are interested in and then just get hired to stay on permanently. And that happens a lot.
I have a partisan political background, a lot of partisan political stuff on my resume. Would that count against me when I'm going for government work, or is it, I mean, it's not something I can really downplay, it's what I did.
Jen, you've seen my resume.
It's fine.
They when I interviewed for my job, they said, "You clearly do not agree with this administration. Will you be able to provide nonpartisan analysis? Will you? Maybe, maybe not. My job is hard every day. But you know, I go out and campaign every weekend."
I'll say what, as speaking for myself and not representing the Department of Justice.
Yes, that was not representing.
I'll give you, it should not. And I can say in the antitrust division, and I've done a lot of hiring, or fair number of hiring in my day, and I just actually hired two lawyers, lateral lawyers, in the last 2 years. One went to Berkeley, if that says anything, law school. The other went to University of Wisconsin Law School. And they had to be approved by the political front office, and they were both hired. That was during the whole period of Gonzalez was the attorney general. But, and I don't pay attention to that, but that's not to say that someone along the way might not look down and look at it. So I think that's a very personal decision, how much of your politics you want to put out there on a resume for anyone, anywhere you go. And I don't think that's only true in government. I think that's anywhere. Obviously, people look at your resume, and they make different judgments based on me. And some people may pay attention to that. I don't pay attention to it. And this paralegal who I was talking about earlier, who worked for me for 4 years, he had an internship with an extremely conservative congressman at one point from Pennsylvania, and that's actually were his leanings as well. And I couldn't care less what his politics were. That's why I was hiring him. So I think most people do not, but I think the truth of the matter is you have to be a realist. If it's out there, they're going to look at the whole picture. Someone might.
Right. You don't know who's on a hiring committee or what their views are. So, I mean, my advice is always, if you can, downplay it as much as you can. I mean, it's more about the skill set when I look at a resume. But, I mean, why give your – why? It's like a black hole sometimes with resumes. You put your resume in, you don't know what happens to it. Or, if you never get a call, you don't know why you didn't get a call.
And unless you have a particular, I have a daughter who's thinking of law school now, and a few years out of college, and when she was doing her resume, and she was had some political activity in college, and she was, asking the same question. I said, my advice is, I probably would not put all my political activity, regardless of which way, it is. I'm not talking one way or another, unless it's a job where you think it's quite relevant. If you want to, fine, but know that everyone looks at the whole thing. So if it's relevant to the job you're applying for, then sure, put it there. If it's not, maybe you don't have to put everything down.
not always.
Did they interview first?
Yeah, another thing I would say, and this is what I did when I was applying for jobs outside of, I mean, just out of law school because I have a very political background, is I didn't put who I worked for. I just put where I worked. I mean, especially if you have Hill experience, you can't leave that off your resume if you're looking for a job in this town. It's so important. But, you know, you can just say you worked in the Senate for X committee. You don't have to say, you know, what office you were in.
Yeah, and I'm not suggesting you wouldn't put down work experience. I think I'm suggesting there's a lot of extracurricular political activity. That's actually what I was focusing on. Okay. I think work experience, you put it down, and it is what it is.
That's a long question.
And we're definitely close to the 7 o'clock mark, so after the 7 o'clock mark, so definitely answer.
We'll talk afterwards if you got a second. Any other questions?
Thank you all so very much. Thank you all. We're thrilled that you are here. So thank you.
Out to the debate.
Yeah.
I know, I'm the debate party.
The comedy hour.
Actually, I met you guys. What's your name?
I'm Rachel.